Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet multimedia artist Lindsay Ketterer-Gates, whose work is featured in a two-artist show opening at 108 Contemporary. Overlap pairs the work of a nationally known mid-career artist, Gates, with an Oklahoma artist. Gates is a studio artist from Pennsylvania who uses the technique of wire looping to create intricately woven large sculptural forms, vessels, clothing forms, teapots, and flora and fauna. Her work is in the collection of the U.S. State Department, the Museum of Art and Design in New York City, and the Yale University Art Gallery, among others. And her work was also a part of the traveling exhibition Innovators and Legends, Generations in Textile and Fibers, which was shown at 108 Contemporary this past winter and is currently touring museums around the country. She's also the guest curator for FiberWorks 2015, which opens tomorrow and runs through July 10th at Living Arts. Overlap also opens tomorrow night for First Friday in the Brady Arts District at 108 Contemporary and will be on display through July 26th. But Gates will have an artist talk tonight at 108 Contemporary beginning at 7 o'clock. Lindsay Ketterer-Gates is my guest today. Lindsay Ketterer-Gates, welcome to Studio Tulsa.
Thanks for having me.
Your work at 108 Contemporary is just really, really gorgeous, and it's such an amazing form you're working with, which is this idea of wire looping to create beautiful sculptures of vessels, of animals, of teapots. I think there's a, is there a purse in there? I know you've done purse forms, purse sort of form, also clothing forms as well, and you use this technique of wire looping. What exactly is wire looping?
Wire looping is a really basic fiber technique of making a series of half knots. People have probably seen it in fiber and would not recognize it transferred into wire, because in fiber, it's collapsing on itself. In the wire, you're seeing every single loop. So it's a very basic technique that the overall look is dependent on just your use of tension and how well you control that.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get started doing it?
I studied fiber arts in college, and I was doing a lot of work in traditional fiber techniques and traditional fibers, and found myself trying to get three-dimensional forms. So, of course, I am trying to starch them and dip them in glue and do all of these other things that are going to give it that stiffness so that I can build in three dimensions, and eventually decided, let's go for a material that will hold its own shape instead of trying to force these other materials to do that.
And how did you come up on wire? Are there other artists using wire like this?
There's lots of other artists who use wire and do fiber techniques in wire. I'm not sure that many of them do the wire looping. It just happens to be a technique that I fell in love with. A lot of people do knitting and crocheting in wire, where you're using a continuous strand. There's a lot of advantages to that, where with the looping, you have to use short pieces of wire about 2 feet in length, and you're constantly stopping and starting. So if you look really closely at the work, you're going to see hundreds of stops and starts where I'm hiding the ends, but hopefully you have to look really closely.
So why that particular way of doing that, where you're creating smaller pieces of wire and sort of knitting them together in a way? Why that way as opposed to the longer wires?
Well, it's pretty funny. I'm terrible at knitting.
Doesn't look like it.
But I think all artists, and I'll speak to fiber artists, who we tend to be very drawn to repetitiveness in techniques. You just fall in love with a certain method and then find ways of using that. And for me, working with this repetitive technique is very meditative and kind of self-soothing. And this particular way of working, this looping, just works for me. It just fits my personality.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you said you were working with traditional fiber and you're wanting to create some three-dimensional forms, what were the forms you were drawn to initially?
I was looking at a lot of contemporary basketry and was making forms that were very vessel-like. I started showing forms that were very vessel-like, and I felt like they would have a handle and a base, but not very traditional, but it was there. So what's interesting when you start showing work like that is that people immediately try to assign a use to it. And these were just sculptures to me. And there really was no reason to have a handle. There really was no reason to have a base, but I was putting them there. And when I stopped including those parts to these sculptures, it immediately transformed how people looked at them. And they looked at them as pieces of small-scale sculpture instead of trying to assign, oh, I could put a wine bottle in that, or that's a purse, or that's a this. And I do draw a lot of inspiration from clothing and textiles from around the world, whether it's minute details or overall form. So I had kind of that double whammy of I'm putting something that could potentially have a function and then also drawing from things that have a function. So it wasn't surprising to me that people were thinking of these as purses or things to assign a use to, but I needed to figure out a way to change that perception.
Now, you still do. I assume you're still doing some work like that, except that it's so stylized that everybody realizes it's a sculpture as opposed to the two spouts on the end of the intertwined teapots.
Yes.
I mean, that's the form, but it's obviously a sculpture. So you're still using these forms. You've made them so much larger in life that you can't find a functional way. It's just a piece of sculpture now.
I always laugh because at one point in my life, I really wanted to create things that were functional. It's just not in me. So at one point, I was doing large-scale felt pieces that were mimicking, say, quilts. I'm really interested in quilts and looking at quilt patterns. But my quilts, my felted quilts, ended up having steel wool embedded in them and steel washers hanging off of them. So I just, you know, it's just not part of my DNA.
not something to cuddle up with on a cold
no.
night. Well, as you began, you know, you started out with fiber and you started saying, I want to get this sort of 3D sculptural form to it. How did you end up where you ended up? Was it a matter of experimentation, putting wires within the fiber? What exactly? And how did you come upon using these colored copper wires you use today?
Well, the wire is kind of an interesting story. You know, I was doing large-scale felt pieces. I was always incorporating wire when I was working in kind of vessel shapes. But when you're in school, you're trying all different things. You haven't found that thing yet that is going to be like your signature style. And I left school and I had no studio. I didn't know where I was going to be living. You know, I was kind of like searching for what I was going to be doing with my life. And I felt like I had the choice of either I could use that as an excuse to stop making work because I didn't have the space to make what I was used to making and I didn't have the money, or I could find other ways of working. And I found that it's just not possible for me to stop making things. It's just part of who I am. And I could carry a roll of wire around and a pair of wire cutters and I could make things. So I could sit anywhere and make small parts. All I needed was a space to create those parts into a larger piece. And so I still work that way today, where if you look at my work, it's made out of a lot of small parts that I can work on anywhere. My studio is very small. And then those small parts end up becoming a vocabulary for larger works.
That must mean lots of planning. I mean, are you like creating architectural renderings when you do these things?
I work similarly to how a dressmaker would work. I'm creating patterns, thinking about overlapping seams. Part of that is probably coming from my background in fiber arts, that I think that way rather than thinking like a metalsmith might think with things other than cold connections. Mm-hmm. So I'm never soldering or doing anything like that. I'm stitching these pieces of screening together. So everything's very planned out. I know ahead of time what the pattern is, then I can lay that out on my screening, which the industrial screening becomes a base for the larger pieces. The looping has a tolerance to where it can no longer hold its shape.
And I think what's really some of the most interesting pieces in the show are these things that use that industrial screening where you can see it, and you've stitched patterns on top of that industrial screening, and it meshes well because you're wire looping is almost as intricate as that, you know, the thing you use in a screen door. It's basically, that's the material you're using, right?
Right. I think of it as my fabric.
Uh-huh.
So I'm using it the same way you would use a fabric. I'm creating resists, and rather than dyeing it, I'm painting it. I'm embroidering on it with other wires, and I'm edging it the same way that you would edge a piece of cloth. Hopefully the screening is then transformed into something that looks soft.
Mm-hmm.
what I love is that you have that mix of the handwork and the industrial working together in one piece.
Now, do you use precious metals at all for the wiring at all?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I would if I had an idea where it needed that, where it called for that. Mm-hmm. But I don't. I usually just use the coated copper. It's interesting. The coated copper wire, you know, is used in industry. And then artists got a hold of it and thought, wow, this is a fabulous material. And the manufacturers responded to that. So now you can get it in such a wide variety of colors that were never available before. Used to have your green, your red, and your amber. And go at it. Make what you want.
one of those cuts and you shut off the bomb.
Exactly. And maybe there was some pink thrown in there. And now you can really get different shades of purple and different shades of red. And so the possibilities are endless with what you can do with that. And it's opened up what I can do. I do a lot of mimicking of textile patternings in my work through recreating imagery in colored wires, where the imagery is actually just coming out of the different wires that I'm choosing to use in different areas of the looping. So I'm creating my own fabric.
I love the fact that on some pieces you'll have a lot of color in them. And then other times it has color, but it's what I call metallic colors. Mm-hmm. You know, the silvers, the goldish, brass-looking, copper maybe look to it. And I think that is equally as interesting work. Do you ever work with the raw wires, like raw copper or silver?
I do sometimes, but again, it has to be something that I don't mind if it changes color over time. Mm-hmm. And I did a whole series of pieces that are based on white-on-white quilts, which I'm really attracted to intricate handwork, but also to just the texture that stitching makes on cloth. And so there's a whole series. There's a silver peacock, silver and white peacock. Right. Mm-hmm. There's another piece called koi.
Yes, the koi is really beautiful. These beautiful embroidered fish on that industrial screening. Yeah.
And so that's all based on that idea of how can I take something that I enjoy that lives in the world of textiles and translate that into the materials that I use so that you're getting that same feel. But I'm working in an extremely different way. I'm using all these very hard materials to create something that looks soft and mimics that same, you know, overall feel.
Now, I've looked at your website, and I don't think there's an example in the show, and I'm not for sure, but I don't think there's a kimono series piece in the show. Is there?
There's one. It's called Metamorphosis.
Yeah, and the koi piece is derivative from that series. And when I say the kimono series, it's you have to think of it as the form of a kimono, but it's three-dimensional and like if you made a steel kimono.
Yes. Not quite as fluid as a normal kimono.
Right. And so what was the attraction of that form?
Those pieces came out of an interest in, again, I'm looking at a lot of textiles from around the globe and just not wanting to recreate these garments, literally, but to springboard off of them. And the kimono forms and also the koi piece, they're made out of two halves that are joined together or not joined together, but they come together to create a whole. And a lot of my work, I'll do that because I find that what's interesting is whoever owns that piece now has the final design decision. How are those going to be displayed? Are they going to be facing each other? Are they not going to be facing each other? And to me, that's a nice way to get the person who owns it to have kind of a little say in the outcome of the piece.
And they can be anything from bookended to they could be put back together into that original
Absolutely.
Form. Or they could be spread apart.
They could be on opposite sides of an entryway, you know, but that's not for me to say. I've seen them displayed every different way, and I've enjoyed every way that they've ended up.
And so that was a conscious decision to have this sort of form that opens up.
Yes.
And basically it's like two book covers and you just sort of open it up and you can do it in any way you like.
There's also something nice that you can play around with as far as bringing meaning into the work. A lot of my work has personal significance, personal meaning that I'm not trying to hit you over the head with. It's very subtle. It's something where I can have these two pieces that now have an interior and an exterior, and I can create kind of a conversation between these two halves, or I can show something that is maybe revealing where the inside of the piece means something different than the outside of the piece. And it's just a way to kind of create a dialogue for myself within the piece that the viewer may or may not pick up on, which is okay to me, and they can assign their own meaning.
Now, you earlier mentioned when you were still working with fiber, you were putting like washers and cotter pins and things like this into some of your fiber works. There are pieces that also use that with this wire looping technique. What is the attraction of using these sort of found objects, if you will?
Well, I should say that I grew up in a household with a mother who was an artist. So I probably had a lot of things around me that were maybe not traditional to have in the home. lots of mannequin parts and other weird things that seemed totally normal to me. And I remember that I would go to one of my favorite stores, which was just industrial materials, and you could buy things by the scoop or the pound. And I'm still attracted to things that you can buy that
hardware
way.
Hardware stores.
Hardware stores. You can scoop a pound of something. I think that's fantastic. And it changes the way you look at something when you see it in mass like that. So those pieces that have lots of washers stitched on them, et cetera, came from just looking at materials in a new way and looking at them in mass and seeing how, you know, when you put washers and lock washers together and you're stitching them to this fabric, they now start to read like lace. So they no longer have this hard kind of material look. They have this very soft and airy look, which is just very intriguing and interesting.
Now, are you messing with patinas on a lot of those found objects?
I am. I am kind of, again, only because if I force it, I know what it's going to end up with, and then I can stop it at that point, and it's not going to change.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you often do when you're using raw wire as well.
Yes.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. If you want that copper wire to eventually turn greenish, you go ahead and make it turn green or silver into
yes.
black of letting it tarnish.
I may have a control issue.
My guest today is Lindsay Ketterer-Gates, a multimedia artist whose work is featured in 108 Contemporary's new exhibit, Overlap, along with another local Oklahoma artist, which is on display beginning tomorrow and running through July 26th. She's also the guest curator for Fiberworks, which is opening at Living Arts tomorrow, and she curated the show. And she's talking tonight. She's doing a talk about Fiberworks on Saturday and running a wire looping workshop, I think, on Sunday.
On Sunday, yes.
Yeah, so you're going to be very busy. But I have to ask you about another material I think you were using for a while. I'm not sure if you're still using now, and that's pistachio shells.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Again, just seeing things in a different light when they're grouped in mass. Starting with pistachio shells really came out of seeing a pile of discarded shells laying somewhere and thinking, what a nice shape, what a nice color, you know, what could I do with this? And that led to trying to incorporate them into vessels that I was making. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and I'm now beading pistachio shells and hanging them in mass off of these vessels. And I do still use them, mm-hmm. but for a while, I was becoming the nut lady, which is not something I aspired to be. And what happened was it seemed more gimmicky and less about what I was trying to do. They weren't my focus because they were pistachio shells. They were my focus because they were an unusual material. I wasn't done with the ideas that I had for them.
They look to me the way sometimes we'll use little small seashells as a decoration mm-hmm. for an object of some sort, or sometimes clothing as
yes.
well. And it looked like that's where sort of the idea came from. But I was just struck by why pistachio shells. Are they necessarily durable?
They are.
Really, are
they? They're durable. They take dye well, which is not something that shows up in my work, but is something I have experimented with. They actually are easy to drill into without cracking. So there were a lot. It's a nice material to work with.
I figured there had to be reasons why pistachios. But
yeah.
And I would assume durability is one, because if you're creating an object of art, you want it to last.
Absolutely.
And
There are a lot of artists who are doing pretty amazing things with natural materials, so we've all come up with interesting and innovative ways to preserve things. But the pistachio shells seem to stay on their own as is. They slightly darken over time, which I really enjoy seeing because I can read how old a piece is. So it ages in the home over time. And it ages to a nice color, so it's okay.
Yeah. Now, several of the pieces are what I'd call vessels. They have this sort of 3D construction and some beautiful, beautiful designs. I mean, just intricate sort of what seem to be abstract designs. But from what you tell me, it sounds like every detail of these pieces are planned out in advance.
What happens is that if you think about the way that me starting these pieces came about, where I'm working on small parts all the time, I'm kind of creating a vocabulary that I can draw from later. So if you were to walk into my studio, you would see a rack with bins and bins and bins of parts, all different parts, some wire holes, some wire, I don't know, there's thousands of things. Uh-huh. So that part is done intuitively. When I have something in mind, I'll start working on how can I make that out of the wire. But the actual creation of the final piece has to be very planned out. I have to know where every seam is going to fall so that I know whether that's going to be something that's exposed or hidden. I have to know exactly how I'm cutting the screening. I have to know exactly where my resist needs to go if I'm putting a layer of paint on the piece. So it's kind of a combination. It's intuitive initially, and then once the idea formulates for what the finished piece is going to be, it is extremely planned out.
Yeah. Some of the most interesting pieces are these peacocks that you have in the show. And they're just gorgeous, gorgeous pieces. And, of course, peacocks are such a gorgeous creature. And you've, through this wire mesh and this wire looping, you created a characterization of that kaleidoscope of color that a peacock will have on their tail feathers. Really, really beautiful.
Thank you. The initial peacock came out of an exhibition that I was invited to do. Artists are often invited to do exhibitions where there's a specific theme. Oh, can you? Teapots are a really common theme. Mm-hmm. And you'll see some teapots in this exhibition as well.
Very whimsical.
To that.
Very whimsical teapots, yeah.
And the peacocks initially came out of an exhibition that I was invited to create a calyx for. So a calyx is an ancient Greek form, which is basically a bowl with two handles. That's an oversimplification, but to give you an idea. And it was used ceremonially. And when thinking about these vessels and doing some research, what I found myself most attracted to was just the gesture of the handles. And so the peacock neck is the same gesture of the as a handle for one of these Greek vessels. And so my response to that exhibition was to create Calyx in Blue, which is the blue peacock that's in the show. And the vessel actually ends up sitting on top of the head of the peacock.
Yeah, no, it's really, really gorgeous. Now, we should also mention, in addition to your own exhibit, you've been the guest curator for FiberWorks, and that's across the Brady District over at the Living Arts. Tell us about that experience. What did you find when you were going through as a curator and then creating a show from it?
Well, I found that fiber arts are alive and well in Oklahoma. when I was invited to be a curator for the exhibition, I was really excited. And when the work started coming in, all the images of the work, I was really impressed with what is going on in fiber arts in this area. It was actually a very difficult show to narrow down because there were so many wonderful things that were submitted. So I tried to narrow things down to have a show that really showed a variety of fiber techniques. There's lots of quilting, lots of really intense embroidery work in the exhibition. I am really attracted to work that combines really bizarre materials together in new ways. So basing things off of fiber that may be traditional fiber techniques, but bringing it into a really contemporary realm. And there's some really great pieces that illustrate that, where people are quilting on vinyl or stitching paper together. There's a wonderful example of traditional weaving that's then creating three-dimensional traffic cones. So lots of interesting examples of fiber art in the exhibition.
Now, when you're putting together the show, you're off-site, you're basically looking at slides. You've had a chance to go through the gallery now and look at the show. Were there any surprises from what you saw on the slides to actually seeing the actual work?
It's funny. I was talking to somebody about this last night that, you know, you can read every piece of information that's given to you about a piece, which includes the size, and your mind still assigns a size to the piece. And so the biggest surprise was how large some of the pieces were compared to what I had in mind. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful surprise. It was nothing negative.
Now, you're also showing with an Oklahoma artist, Amanda Bradway.
Amanda Bradway.
Yeah, and just as you're a little obsessive with the wire looping, she's doing some amazingly complex work with paper.
She is doing unbelievable work. I have to say, I flew in yesterday and had a chance to go into 108 Contemporary, and I was completely blown away by the work that she's created for that space. I don't know her. I know her work through images, and I understand that most of the work in the show is created for this specific show, so brand new work. She has one piece that's an installation along one wall. It takes up the entire wall, and it's just stunning. Yeah. Stunning work.
And I think your two works complement each other very, very well.
I think we both have an obsessive nature. In reading a lot on her blog, I think that we work in a similar way where we find that it's a very meditative process to do these repetitive techniques. So I think that the work looks great together for multiple reasons and works on an intellectual level together as well.
Now, you've been working with a number of forms for a while. How is your work evolving? What are sort of the things you're experimenting with now?
Well, now I'm really experimenting with mimicking the textile patterning through color patterning in the looping. So where I used to do a lot of looping that was silver or black, and I've now incorporated a lot of color by changing the color of the wire, I've been really heavily influenced lately by my surroundings. I live along a national park, and I work in a national park. So looking at nature, looking at the gesture that different natural forms make, and how can I capture that in a piece made out of very stiff materials. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the work is evolving into being more colorful, more gestural, and probably also slightly more obsessive, yeah, if that's possible.
So what national park do you live near? Delaware Water Gap?
Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area. We're actually the second most visited national park in the United States.
Yeah, beautiful Delaware Valley right there.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so how is that influencing your work, being in there?
Well, I actually work for Peters Valley School of Craft, which mm-hmm. is a national craft school located within the national park. And I'd say that working there is the biggest influence on my work, because I'm getting the benefit of, say, 12 professional artists in a variety of media coming to me each week throughout the summer months. But as far as just the natural settings, just that the peacefulness that I'm surrounded with, the variety of wildlife and flora that I see on a daily basis, you know, it has a way of working itself into the work.
No, we wish you great success with it and hope a lot of people come out to 108 Contemporary, because it's a gorgeous, gorgeous show.
Thank you.
Multimedia and sculptural artist Lindsay Ketterer-Gates speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's paired with Oklahoma artist Amanda Bradway in the two-artist show Overlap, which opens tomorrow night for First Friday in the Brady Arts District at 108 Contemporary and will be on display through July 26th. She's also the guest curator for Fiberworks 2015, which also opens tomorrow at Living Arts. For details on the two exhibits and her appearances through the weekend, visit 108contemporary.org and livingarts.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.